My name is Anja Guttenberger, and this is my podcast, Bauhaus Faces. Welcome back to the Bauhaus Faces podcast, today with a bonus episode. Thanks for tuning in again. In the early 1930s, a small group of young architects left the Bauhaus in Dessau and followed their teacher Hannes Meyer to the Soviet Union. They went in search of new possibilities for architecture, convinced that the ideas they had developed at the Bauhaus could find a future there. Their paths, however, would soon diverge in unexpected ways. This episode returns to that group, often referred to as the Red Bauhaus Brigade, and focuses on two more members, Konrad Püschel and René Mensch. Picking up on my previous conversation with Daniel Talesnik about Tibor Weiner, we take a broader view of what it meant to continue architectural work across shifting political and geographic contexts. Püschel's trajectory leads from the Soviet Union back to Germany and onward to North Korea, where he contributed to post-war reconstruction. Mensch's path, by contrast, took him from the Soviet Union to Iran, not once but twice in his life. Together, their biographies offer insight into the conditions under which architectural practice was negotiated, adapted, and at times constrained. Although I had originally planned to include Philipp Tolziner in this bonus episode alongside Konrad Püschel and René Mensch, I'll have to ask for a little more patience on that front. The good news, however, is that this delay allows for something even more substantial. Together with Daniel Talesnik, I was able to invite Tatjana Efrusi back to the podcast, whom you may remember from the second part of the episode on Hannes Meyer. In mid-May, I'll be sitting down again with the two of them, this time to focus entirely on Philipp Tolziner and his remarkable story. So, while there's a small delay, it comes with the promise of a richer and more in-depth discussion, one that I believe will be well worth the wait. For an introduction to the Red Bauhaus Brigade, its origins and key figures, I recommend starting with the episode on Tibor Weiner featuring Daniel Talesnik. You will find additional context in part 2 of the Hannes Meyer episode with Tatjana Efrusi. If you want to follow new episodes of Bauhaus Faces, you can subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube or wherever you're listening to the podcast to stay up to date. This also really helps the podcast grow, as the platforms are more likely to recommend it to others who haven't come across it yet. You can also sign up for the newsletter on bauhausfaces.com and follow along on Instagram for updates and a bit of behind-the-scenes content. And if you enjoy the podcast, I would be very grateful if you passed it on, whether to friends, family, colleagues, or anyone else who might be interested in the Bauhaus and its stories. Let's now dive into a new episode of Bauhaus Faces and shine a light on not one, but two architects of the Bauhaus, Konrad Püschel and René Mensch.
So today we're going to talk about two of the members of the so-called Red Bauhaus Brigade, Konrad Püschel, a German architect, and René Mensch, a Swiss architect. They are two out of a group of seven that we've introduced already in the previous episode. We've already talked in depth about Tibor Weiner, the Hungarian architect, and we will have a forthcoming episode where, along with Tatjana Efrusi, we will talk in depth about Philipp Tolziner, a German architect. Interesting that these are the four architects that I focus on the most in my dissertation, mainly Weiner, but in some detail also Püschel, Tolziner, and Mensch. There's a full chapter in my dissertation, and they will continue to be present in my forthcoming book. And these four architects are my focus because they have careers after the period that they're together as members of the Red Bauhaus Brigade. Mainly, they survive that period because Scheffler, Moimann, and Urban do not survive the Soviet stage of their careers. But these four architects do have careers afterwards. Not all of them outside of the Soviet Union, because Tolziner, as we know, survives the Gulag, and we will talk in detail about that, but never leaves. He continues to work after he is liberated and rehabilitated in the Soviet Union, first in Perm, where he had been imprisoned, and eventually he goes back to Moscow and continues working there. But what's interesting about this four architects, as opposed to the other three, meaning Scheffler, Moimann, and Urban, is that they were never members of the Communist Party in the stage that they were together in the Soviet Union. And we will talk about that in some detail. So Konrad Püschel, German architect, he was born in Wernsdorf. That's a village in Glauchau in Germany. He was born in 1907, and he was the son of a clergyman. Interesting to his career is that before enrolling in the Bauhaus, he was an apprentice of a carpenter. And this was very usual for this generation of architects that went to the Bauhaus, that one of the things that they were required to do before enrolling was bring some either craft or artistic training already. And he enrolls in the Bauhaus in the summer of 1926. This is before the architecture department had been established in 1927 by Hannes Meyer. And he has, quote unquote, a usual path in the Bauhaus as all students. He did the four course with Josef Albers, and he took classes with Kandinsky. He took classes with Paul Klee, with Jost Schmidt, and so on. Eventually, in 1927, he will enroll in the newly inaugurated architecture department, where he will be a student of Hannes Meyer, of Hans Wittwer, and other architects that were teaching there at the time. He will work eventually after the Bauhaus, and after he fights the war for Germany. We will talk about that in some detail in a minute. He will work in Weimar as a teacher, and he will specialize in Dorfplanung, village planning, which is, let's say, some sort of subset or specialization within town planning at large. And it makes sense when we see some of the classes that he took in the Bauhaus, because he was a student of a course that was called Zoning and Planning, that was instructed by Hannes Meyer. He also took a class with Marc Stamm on urban development. And we can see also that some of his student projects will relate to the planning of small urban units, if you will. There is a planning when he's a student for a cooperative called Vogelgesang, Gelbe.
Before we move on, it's worth pausing for a moment to look at this project that Daniel just mentioned called Collective Farm Vogelgesang Elbe. In many ways, it sets the tone for Konrad Püschel's later work. In 1930, still at the Bauhaus and together with his fellow student Leo Wassermann, Püschel developed this project. At first glance, it might seem like a fairly local, even technical exercise, the transformation of an existing estate into a cooperative farm. But in fact, it revealed something much more fundamental about his thinking. What Konrad Püschel and Leo Wassermann had in mind went beyond simply rearranging the buildings of an existing estate. They were proposing a fundamentally different social and economic structure. Farmers, in their view, would no longer work individually, but collectively, sharing livestock, machinery, and infrastructure. Their thinking extended beyond agriculture itself. They included administration, workshops, and public facilities, imagining all of these as part of one interconnected system. And they made these relationships visible in a kind of clustered diagram, showing how each part relates to the others, a method they had learned from the Bauhaus teachers in the building department, Hans Wittwer and Ludwig Hilbersheimer. Looking back, this early project almost seems like a model project. The ideas Konrad Püschel explored here, collectivization, planning, and the integration of architecture into overarching economic systems, remained central to his work for decades, from the GDR right through to projects in North Korea.
He's not a member of the Communist Party. We've mentioned that already, not at this stage at least. And he leaves the Bauhaus in 1930 and will go in 1931 to the Soviet Union, hired along with the other Bauhaus Brigade members by the trust that's called Giproftus, which is the Construction of Higher and Technical Education Colleges Trust. He has a lot of technical knowledge of materials and construction from the courses that he took in the Bauhaus. And this is something that will help him and his fellow brigade members in their inception in the professional world in Moscow. Because unlike their colleagues, they didn't have professional experience, but they did have more experience on materials and construction techniques. So they could provide that as an expertise to share with their new colleagues. Interestingly, Kuchel also participated in one of the entries to the competition to the Palace of the Soviets, not the one where Weiner, Tolziner, and Urban collaborated with Hannes Meyer, but he participated with another architect called Fyodor Ivanovich Zernovsky. And in his memoir, he considers that this entry was positively evaluated once it was handed in. He's Ingrid Proftus until 1933, and he will move along with Tibor Weiner and Philipp Tolziner to another trust called Gorstoy Project. It's the City Building Projects Trust. And while working there, this group is contacted by Hans Schmidt. Hans Schmidt, along with Marc Stamm, had been working on the design of the city of Orsk from this trust. Let's remember that Hans Schmidt and Marc Stamm had arrived to the Soviet Union as part of the Ernst May Brigade. And eventually, when the Ernst May Brigade is dissolved, they find themselves working in this other trust called the Gorstoy Project. So, Puschel, Weiner, and Tolziner are recruited by Hans Schmidt to work with him in the design of the city of Orsk. And this task will involve eventually moving to Orsk and working on site. And the work on site, as described by Puschel in his memoirs, involved training local workers in construction. Most of the workers that were building in Orsk had no training in construction work. Not only that, most of them had no construction tools. So when they came to work, if they didn't bring their own tools, a lot of what they were using had to be built on site by them, like right angles, for instance. So all of this was training people from scratch to build, and they had something to do with that as well. They are there between 1933 and 1936, working in the design and eventually in the design and construction of the city of Orsk. In 1936, they are fired from Gorstoy Project, and Puschel in particular moves to another trust. And he will remain in the Soviet Union until the summer of 1937, when he will return to Germany. When he goes back to Germany, he goes back to his hometown, and not unsurprisingly, the Gestapo is waiting for him. So he is interrogated for 2 days, and luckily, since he had never joined the Communist Party, they left him go only with a warrant. Due to this, to the fact that he had been interrogated as soon as he came back to Germany, he decides to leave the area, and he will eventually work in Thuringia for a former Bauhaus junior master called Alfred Arndt. So you can see that the Bauhaus networks are always being activated. Later in life, after the Second World War, when he goes and teaches in Weimar, that is also possible because of a recommendation letter of a former Bauhaus classmate. So there's a support network, and that's a big part of what I'm interested in, how not only Bauhauslers, but people that had formerly worked together in the Soviet Union do become some sort of support network that allow each other to find jobs or to activate contacts. We saw that clearly in Weiner and how he got to different jobs. He is drafted into the German army in 1940. He goes into the infantry and mainly fights in Italy. But eventually, he will find himself as far afield as Tunisia. Another interesting thing happens when he's imprisoned. He claims in his memoir that he does survive in this imprisonment, mainly providing architectural or design services, which is interesting and will connect him to the experience we will see in the next episode on Tolziner, because he will claim that he survives mainly the Gulag by providing design and architectural design services. After he's liberated from the Soviet camp in Vilna, he will go to Weimar to join the faculty of the Hochschule. And this is possible because of a recommendation of Gustav Hasenpflug, a former Bauhäusler. And he will specialize in village planning, in Dorfplanung. And he will teach this throughout his career there. Mainly the design of rural areas, the refurbishing of villages, and so on and so forth. In 1954, the Ministry of Construction of the GDR will recruit him to go to North Korea to help with the reconstruction efforts after the Korean War, which finished in mid-1953. And he will be asked in particular to help with the redesign or refurbishing or reinvention, to be more precise, of the cities of Hanhung and Hungham, which were almost completely destroyed during the war. There is a book that I use for reference specifically on this period by an author by the last name of Armstrong, and he claims that 95% of the housing in these two cities was destroyed during the Korean War. The story goes that Otto Grotewohl, the then GDR prime minister, had promised personally in the 1954 Geneva conference to Kim Il-sung that the Germans would send a task force to help them with the reconstruction of their cities. So, in that capacity, the son of Otto Grotewohl, Hans Grotewohl, who was an architect, asks Konrad Puschel to go, because basically Otto Grotewohl asks his architect son to coordinate this effort. He will go to North Korea between 1954 and 1958. Originally, there are around 175 German specialists that will travel to North Korea, but we know that by 1959, there are almost 350 helping and working there. He will do town planning there, and based on the descriptions that I have read, some of them based on his work, and some of them delivered by himself, because he will publish in 1958-59 a report of his work in North Korea. He designed a main avenue that took its form or model, you could say, from Stalin Allee, that had been started in 1949. So it makes sense from a chronological point of view. And that there was a big square that was mainly based on Alexanderplatz. So you can see that things that he knew would serve him as models for the types of designs that he did in North Korea. We know also that by 1956, around 6,000 residences had been built, low-rise buildings and mainly housing. He was eventually replaced, and another German specialist is sent, and the reconstruction efforts will finish at around 1962. He will teach in Weimar again when he returns. And then at around 1964, he becomes very active in the efforts of refurbishing the Bauhaus building in Dessau, which will not be inaugurated until 1976. But the plans and the project of this refurbishment do begin at around 1964. And that's more or less the career of Konrad Puschel, who will pass as late as 1997. One of the classes that he took in the Bauhaus, although for some reason it's not declared in his diploma, but I have evidence that he was a student, is that he worked under Ludwig Hilbersheimer in a project to draw a master plan for the city of Dessau while they were there. And there's a drawing that survives in the archive of the study of circulation in a cross street.
This master plan for Dessau, by the way, is a fascinating and still relatively little known chapter in Bauer's history. What began as an urban analysis ultimately took the form of a 48-page Leporello, an elaborate folded publication that combined maps, diagrams, photographs, texts and student designs into a single carefully composed whole. Three Bauhaus students, Hubert Hoffmann, Wilhelm Hess and Cornelius van der Linden, were selected by Ludwig Hilbersheimer to present this work at the CIAM Congress 1933. The setting of this Congress was, to say the least, unusual. Originally planned to take place in Moscow, it had to be relocated due to the changing political situation in the Soviet Union. As a pragmatic alternative, participants gathered on a ship traveling to Athens. During this journey, architects and urban planners presented analysis of 34 cities, including Amsterdam, London, and yes, Dessau, using a standardized cartographic method developed by Cornelis van Esteren, then president of CIAM. This shared visual language was intended to make cities comparable and to contribute to a broader goal, defining the principles of the functional city, structured according to use and organized through modern systems of circulation. Within this context, the contribution of the Bauhaus students was remarkably ambitious, not only in its analytical depth, but also in its visual and graphic execution. Their Leporello stood out as both a research project and a communication tool, translating complex urban ideas into a compelling visual format. This extraordinary congress was also documented on film. Laszlo Molinagy was commissioned to capture the journey in a roughly 30-minute film titled The Architects' Congress, which is now available online, surprisingly. Of course, I will link this film for you in the show notes. By the way, if you are interested in learning more about Ludwig Hilbesheimer's approach to urban planning, I recommend the Bauhaus Faces episode featuring Ute Pörschke and Kevin Harrington. But let's return now to Konrad Pischl.
So you could say that he was involved from early on in urban planning efforts. And we could see it also in the type of courses that he took in the Bauhaus. So clearly, that is something that will influence his career thereafter, because that's what he will teach in Weimar, although at the scale of villages. And what he was called to do in North Korea was city planning, even though he was in charge more of housing. But he had to lead the efforts of redesigning two full cities, a city and a port, the second and the third largest cities in North Korea. So there is a continuity, and the training that he received at the Bauhaus will determine the type of work that he does thereafter. Specifically in the work that they do in Orsk under Hans Schmidt, that is also city planning. And although they were in charge of quartals or portions of the city and their infrastructural equipment, meaning schools and so on, it is city planning that involves the definition of streets, what defines or characterizes a street, how do you build a street profile, and so on. Where do you put a square? What type of programs do you put in the square? There is an apocryphal story, apocryphal in the sense that I haven't been able to fully confirm it, but the person that replaced him in North Korea will criticize him for doing a square, the one that I'm mentioning that took its model after Alexanderplatz, that had commercial programs. And there was a discussion of why commercial programs and not civic and institutional ones, and what constitutes a communist city, and ideological discussions of that sort. So there is a connection. He published a memoir. So in this case, like in the case of Tolziner, we can follow his work also based on what he himself describes that he did, which is not the case, at least not as an organized memoir, there's bits and pieces, not the case with Tibor Weiner or with René Mensch, although there are small biographical texts in both cases. We will see later that Mensch writes in the early 30s a text about his experience in the Soviet Union, which is filtered by the fact that he was a Swiss Catholic. So it's a text that's called A Swiss Catholic in the Soviet Brigades in the Soviet Union, which is published in a book that's called Swiss Urban Planners with the Soviets that came out, I think, in 1935. Mensch, born at around the same time as all of these students that I work on, because he was born in 1908, and he's Swiss, he's from Basel, and born into a Catholic household. His father owned a painting and plastering business, and eventually, before studying architecture, he does train as a draftsman. So he's connected in some way or another to the industry that his father worked on, which is the construction industry, right? And he will enroll in the Bauhaus in 1927-28. This is the year where the architecture program has been started already, but as any new student in the Bauhaus, he has to go through the four course with Albers, and we can see in his diploma that he takes classes with some of the usual suspects. He will be a student of Paul Klee, he will be a student of Oskar Schlemmer, he will be a student of Hannes Meyer, he will take classes with Ludwig Hilbersheimer, and also with Marc Stamm. That was in the capacity of a guest lecturer in the Bauhaus in the winter semester of 1928-29. Again, he will be very proficient in technical subjects. This comes from the construction classes that Alkar Rudelt would teach, and also by the classes that Hans Riedel taught. And as I mentioned, in the case of Püschel, the fact that they were very well prepared in the areas of construction and construction management, not only theoretical, because they both worked in the ADGB project in Brno. So they also saw some of these things being implemented. But they had a good knowledge of that. I mean, having had a class on reinforced concrete with Rudel and Iro construction did give them some sort of edge when they arrived in the Soviet Union, and that was some knowledge that they could share with their colleagues. After graduating from the Bauhaus, there is a story that I read in the papers of Tolziner, if I'm not mistaken, that he worked, interestingly, with Richard Neutra in Berlin in 1931. We know for a fact that Neutra is in Germany because he's invited by Mies van der Rohe to teach as a guest lecturer in the Bauhaus. So from that point of view, it will make sense. And an example of what we were talking before, Neutra was working in a competition for the Ukrainian State Theater in Kharkov, and apparently Mensch helped him on that. But in 1931, we know that he goes to the Soviet Union to join Gryprovtus, along with the other six members of the so-called Bauhaus Brigade, or the Red Bauhaus Brigade, and that he will be there for 2 years, working along his former classmates. And eventually, he will move to another trust, to the Central Soyuz Trust, which is the Central Union of Consumers Cooperatives. He's the first of the Red Bauhaus Brigade members to quit the Soviet Union, but he will return to Basel in 1934 with a Russian wife, which allows us to speculate that when he writes some letters in 1935, asking if he can return to work in Moscow, it had to do with the fact that he had married a Russian and maybe she wanted to go back to see her family or who knows what. That never happened. He comes back to Basel in 1934. He works for a brief period there in his own private practice. And in 1935, Mensch will accept a job in Tehran, in Iran. He's hired by a German construction company, Hochtief, which is a huge construction company that exists until today. And he will work with them until 1937 in Tehran. And that year, he will move on to work for the Iranian National Bank. And he will be working for them between 37 and 41. So, for instance, the Bank Meli in Shiraz, the main architect is Mohsen Foroughi, this Iranian Beaux-Arts-trained architect. Presumably, Mensch worked on the building side of the operation. Who knows if he was involved directly in the design? That has not been possible to confirm. But we can see that there is some sort of hybrid between what you could say was contemporary architecture by that point in time and some Persian elements in the treatment of the facade, certain screens, and so on. In 1941, he will return to Switzerland. And from 1942 to 1945, he has to comply with his military service in the Swiss Army. Afterwards, from 1945 until more or less 1953, and I'll tell you in a minute why I signal 1953 as a key year, he will again have a practice of his own and work on his own designs in Basel. But in 1953, he's hired by two Swiss to go to Santiago de Chile, and he will design two factories that I haven't been able to locate yet. But I know through the Swiss embassy in Chile that his clients and Mensch himself did live in Chile. So it's a fact that he was there. He goes back to Switzerland after what I think was a year in Chile. And eventually in 1957, he returns to Tehran. And he will be there until 1975. And in the second period in Iran, he will mainly design factories and work on private residences. And there are images of this work that can be found in the Tolziner archive. Because when Tolziner is doing the effort of trying to reconstruct the careers of his former colleagues, he asks Mensch to send him photographs of what he had done both in Iran and in Switzerland. So that's a little bit how it is possible to reconstruct the career of Mensch. He dies in 1980 in Locarno, so way before Puschel and way before Tolziner. There are, in the second period that he lives in Iran, some modern buildings, modern in the sense that you could say they're run-of-the-mill. One of them you could even describe as neo-brutalist. And the houses, they are in a category of their own. Clearly, they're for very wealthy clients. There's a house for a minister called Mir Jalali. That's like a modern-looking villa very big, very nice, with a swimming pool, but it's in complete tension, you could say, with another house that can be found in the Tolciner archive of the work of René Mensch, which is a house for someone called Habib Sabet, and that this is completely quote-unquote French-looking, where traditional architectural styles are deployed. This gentleman, for example, called Habib Sabet, I could detect exactly who he was. I know who the minister was and why he was important. They are literally very well-off people. So the fact that he had access to this type of clients is already telling. But again, I am not 100% sure if he was the leading architect. There is a building from the second period, unclear if he was the architect or if he was working in the construction part, but it's a bank that is labeled Texan and it's in Tehran. And you could say again that it's a high rise. It's a very contemporary looking building. I have images for another building called the Man Building or Mantou. In another documents, you can see that in one of the buildings, the Lufthansa offices are in the first floors. Tehran at this point in time looks quite international. Perhaps not the whole city, because I don't have images to prove that, but definitely some of the buildings within it, based in this building that I found in the archives of Tolciner. There are images also for a kitchen in the Pahlavi Hospital in Tehran, and that is more of a contemporary-looking building. Very rough in its finishings, but clearly a functional building where reinforced concrete is used along with bricks. It's a building that needed to be ventilated, so you can see how he solved that with certain screening elements too. And there are more buildings for the Pahlavi Hospital in Tehran, some buildings that have some machinery inside of them, but all looking very, yes, I think it's safe to use the word functional in this context. So it's a very eclectic body of work, the one that can be found in Tehran. There are some buildings in the Caspian Sea, a vacation colony, different then again from the previous buildings that I encountered. So there's not one particular style that can describe the work. And then again, I'm not completely sure he was the leading architect for all of these projects. And the fact that they are of quote-unquote diverse styles, well, it speaks to several things. You could say that on the one hand, you could think that it's the work of an unprejudiced architect that could design and quote-unquote speak different architectural languages, or that he could respond to whatever the clients were asking him for. And that was part of the approach he had as an architect in those years. I did show the images at some point in time to a Iranian architect living in Los Angeles, and also to an Iranian architect that was my classmate in Columbia University that went back to Tehran after we studied together. And they both described the work as very usual for the period in Tehran. Not exceptional, but the fact that he could do it and do it well is telling of a good architectural training.
And with that, we have come to the end of this bonus episode on Konrad Püschel and René Mensch, two architects whose careers, in very different ways, reflect how their common ground at the Bauhaus shifted to collective work in the Soviet Union and then culminated in their own individual careers far away from Europe. Thank you, Daniel, for generously sharing your time and insights once again, helping to deepen our understanding of the architects of the Red Bauhaus Brigade. And don't forget about the other upcoming bonus episode with Daniel and Tatjana Efrusi, which will air at the end of May or beginning of June. If you liked this episode or any other episode of Bauhaus Faces, I'd really appreciate it if you took a moment to rate Bauhaus Faces, whether with 5 stars on Spotify and Apple Podcasts or a thumbs up on YouTube. And now there's nothing left to say but tune in next time to a new episode of Bauhaus Faces.